So this is February 17th, 2012, and I'm going to be talking about what one physician called the tyranny of positive thinking. I'm going to start with an article from the New York Times from last August. It's called The Power of Negative Thinking, and it's an opinion piece by an Oliver Berkman, who is the author of a forthcoming book called The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. And I'll just wade right into this. Last month in San Jose, California, 21 people were treated for burns after walking barefoot over hot coals as part of an event called Unleash the Power Within, starring the motivational speaker Tony Robbins. If you're anything like me, a cynical retort might suggest itself. What exactly did they expect would happen? In fact, there's a simple secret to firewalking. Coal is a poor conductor of heat to surrounding surfaces, including human flesh, so with quick, light steps, you'll usually be fine. I saw this done in Indonesia, the island of, I can't remember whether it was Java or Bali. I was there with Roshi Kaplow and a group of Sangha members to visit the largest Buddhist monument in the world, the monument at Borobudur on the island of Java. And we succumbed to an invitation to see some firewalking, and one of our group was a podiatrist, and after this remarkable demonstration, he coaxed one of the firewalkers over and he examined his feet, and he then came back and said to us that they were unusually thickly calloused. But other than that, it certainly seemed like quite a demonstration. But those are the pros. So I'll just go on here. But Mr. Robbins and his acolytes have little time for physics. To them, it's all a matter of mindset. Cultivate the belief that success is guaranteed and anything is possible. One singed but undeterred participant told the San Jose Mercury News, "I wasn't at my peak state. What if all this positivity is part of the problem? What if we're trying too hard to think positive and might do better to reconsider our relationship to, quote, negative emotions and situations? Consider the technique of positive visualization, a staple not only of Robbins-style seminars, but also of corporate team-building retreats and business bestsellers. According to research by the psychologist Gabrielle Oettingen and her colleagues, visualizing a successful outcome under certain conditions can make people less likely to achieve it." And then it describes the experiment that I won't take the time to read because we have a lot to read this morning. Or take affirmations, those cheery slogans intended to lift the user's mood by repeating them. I am a lovable person. My life is filled with joy. Psychologists at the University of Waterloo concluded that such statements make people with low self-esteem feel worse, not least because telling yourself you're lovable is liable to provoke the grouchy internal counterargument that really you're not. Even goal setting, the ubiquitous motivational technique of managers everywhere, isn't an undisputed boon. Fixating too vigorously on goals can distort an organization's overall mission in a desperate effort to meet some overly narrow target. And research by several business school professors suggests that employees consumed with goals are likelier to cut ethical corners. though much of this research is new, the essential insight isn't. Ancient philosophers and spiritual teachers understood the need to balance the positive with the negative, optimism with pessimism, a striving for success and security with an openness to failure and uncertainty. Let me just pause and just point out what many of you know, that in Zen, we're not trying to sell ourselves an attitude. We're not trying to contrive to be something we're not. We're not trying to be positive. We're not trying to be negative. We're trying to be authentic to what is happening right now. Our what is going on in our mind right now, to be aware of it, with neither suppressing it nor clinging to it, whatever it is. Not doing anything with it, but leaving it alone, and letting it be. He goes on, the Stoics recommended the premeditation of evils, or deliberately visualizing the worst-case scenario. This tends to reduce anxiety about the future. When you soberly picture how badly things could go in reality, you usually conclude that you could cope. Besides, they noted, imagining that you might lose the relationships and possessions you currently enjoy increases your gratitude for having them now. Positive thinking, by contrast, always leans into the future, ignoring present pleasures. This too is right in accord with Zen and Buddhist teaching. I've often spoken here about how maintaining an awareness of our mortality, of the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death, can really support practice. It prevents us from getting too complacent. And it does make us appreciate what we have now more than ever. Not to dwell in thoughts about all this. That's the other mistake. But from time to time, there is a place in Zen practice for reflection. Not in pure Zen practice, doesn't last long. We're not going through some kind of lengthy exercises of imagination, but it does. I think it does help to be, from time to time, to reflect on the impermanent nature of things, including our relationships and our bodies. I've noticed in recent years that when these moments of such reflection come to me about the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death, it's becoming more finely tuned, which is recently I caught myself thinking, okay, I wonder which system will break down first. Circulatory system, the nervous system, the digestive system. For all of us, it's just a question of time. And then he does mention Buddhist meditation here. Buddhist meditation, too, is arguably all about learning to resist the urge to think positively, to let emotions and sensations arise and pass regardless of their content. It might even have helped those agonized firewalkers. Very brief training in meditation, according to a 2009 article in the Journal of Pain, brought significant reductions in pain, not by ignoring unpleasant situations or refusing to feel them, but by turning non-judgmentally toward them. Okay, this is just standard Zen practice. This is what you're doing. That's what we're learning to do on the mat. Neither ignoring the pain, and the pain can be either physical or emotional, neither ignoring the pain, nor refusing to feel them, but just simply being aware of them and not cling to them. So let them move through us. From this perspective, the relentless cheer of positive thinking begins to seem less like an expression of joy and more like a stressful effort to stamp out any trace of negativity. Mr. Robbins' trademark smile starts to resemble a rictus. A positive thinker can never relax, lest an awareness of sadness or failure creep in. And telling yourself that everything must work out is poor preparation for those times when they don't. You can try, if you insist, to follow the famous self-help advice to eliminate the word failure from your vocabulary. It's a preposterous kind of idea. But then you'll just have an inadequate vocabulary when failure strikes. There is a koan in one of the koan collections of the Blue Cliff record where a monk asks Zen master Yunmen, what is, I forget the particular question, what is the ultimate truth or something to that effect. And he says, every day is a good day. Now that can be misunderstood as the sort of thing that we're reading about here, this positive thinking. But when he says every day is a good day, it's not good, the good that stands in opposition to bad. It's something beyond good and bad. The social critic Barbara Ehrenreich has persuasively argued that the all-positive approach, with its rejection of the possibility of failure, helped bring on our present financial crises. The psychological evidence, backed by ancient wisdom, certainly suggests that it is not the recipe for success that it purports to be. Mr. Robbins reportedly encourages firewalkers to think of the hot coals as cool moss. Here's a better idea. Think of them as hot coal. And as a San Jose fire captain, himself a wise philosopher, told the Mercury News, we discourage people from walking over hot coal. I have to confess, I have thought about trying walking over hot coals just to test my mind control, but I think about a lot of things like that I don't pursue, follow up on. Now, he mentioned Barbara Ehrenreich, and I have an interview of her here. She wrote a book called Brightsided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. She herself. This is from an online site called AlterNet, and the interview is by an Emily Wilson, and this is actually from 2009. So when she went to be treated for breast cancer, she was exhorted to think positively, and when she expressed feelings of fear and anger, she was chided for being negative. And then it mentions here in this introduction that she's the author of 16 books. Personally, I love her writing. She's a beautiful, elegant writer. And this one I just mentioned is this time was her latest book. Positive thinking is different, she says, from being cheerful or good-natured. It's believing that the world is shaped by our wants and desires, and that by focusing on the good, the bad ceases to exist. Let me just look to what's behind this business of positive thinking and suppressing the negative. In a word, I think it grows out of a sense of ego, of the self and its power, the self and its ability to control. That's what it is in that bottom. It's based on this illusion of the self as a completely self-standing agency, something that effects what it wants. Yeah, it's based on wanting, on our desires. It's based on the illusion of control. In that sense, it's kind of a form of grandiosity. This belief in the power of positive thinking, in the sense that they mean it, that we can somehow shape events. It's also, I would suggest, a kind of magical thinking, like if we don't step on the cracks in the sidewalk, that will prevent bad things from happening. It's kind of immature. It's kind of childish. It's also goal-oriented, as we heard from this last article we just read, fixing on a goal. All of this is contrary to Zen practice. We're not trying to hold on to a goal in the mind. Even if we feel a genuine aspiration to come to awakening for the sake of all beings, that's not something we want to keep going back to in our mind. We don't want to hold on to it mentally. We don't need to. If that's our aspiration, it's not going to go away. It may slip out of our awareness for years. This happens. People come to Zen practice and they're clear about wanting to come to self-realization, come to awaken to the nature, their own nature, the nature of reality, in order to be able to help others more effectively. And then it sort of gets submerged in the busyness of life and can seem to have disappeared, but I don't believe for a minute it really goes away. It just gets covered up by all the busyness of life and the many demands that so many people have on their lives and their time. But we don't really have to worry about losing our innate longing to realize the nature of things, the nature of reality, our true self. The problem comes when we cling to it as a thought. In Zen, strictly speaking, we're not trying to effect change. We're not trying to create an effect. Of course, we want effects. We want benefits. Anyone would want that. And so, of course, but the pure Zen practice, pure Zazen, or not just Zazen, but doing this both outside the Zendo as well as in the Zendo, this is not effecting, not going about with a project in the mind of effecting change, but not ignoring the need for change. It's really, strictly speaking, it's not doing anything. In Zazen, we're not doing anything. We aren't, really. We're letting thoughts settle, and we're looking We're letting thoughts settle so that we can see the mind, see things as they are. So it's not doing in the sense of embarking on a project, on a self-improvement project. But it's not doing either. This is the paradox that we always come to when we talk about Zen. Effort is needed. We can't just resign ourselves to the status quo and do nothing. So we need to strive to get beyond doing, beyond striving. This is the ultimate paradox in practice. We need to work so hard to get to the point where we can just relax and let things be. Just let things be. Because underlying everything I'm saying is the understanding, at least the faith, that ultimately we don't need to change things or become something different than what we are. We just need to get out of the way and let change happen. And change will happen if we can learn to detach from thoughts. That's what it always comes down to. By detaching from thoughts, by learning how to settle into a state of no mind, no thought, then we become the change. By getting out of the way, we evolve. Not by setting about it as a project in the mind. In the introduction to this article, this interview of Barbara Ehrenreich, the interviewer says in her new book she examines how the positive thinking movement was started by Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science, and an amateur metaphysician named Phineas Parkhurst Quimby. That's got to be a fake name. In response to Calvinism, how being positive became mandatory in corporate culture, and how she thinks prosperity preachers such as Joel Osteen of Lakewood Church in Houston encouraged a culture of debt by telling their congregations that God wants them to have a big house and a nice car. So here's the interview. Emily Wilson, at the beginning of the book, you talk about going to be treated for breast cancer and being told to think positively. Was that what started you thinking about this? And then Ehrenreich, that was my first exposure to positive thinking as an ideology. I was just astounded and dismayed by it. Here I was in a real crisis in my life, and people were trying to market pink ribbon teddy bears to me. And where I thought I would find sort of sisterly support on the internet, I found instead the constant exhortations to be cheerful and to embrace my disease. She laughs. Question: what is the difference between being told to try and stay upbeat and to have a good attitude and positive thinking? Ehrenreich: I think it's a slippery slope. Once you start on how you have to face your problem with a good attitude, they start looking for justifications for that, and it became, you actually get better only if you are upbeat, only if you visualize your recovery, and so on. Here, I think that we can distinguish between the fantasy, the magical thinking that we can change objective reality, that as compared to changing our experience of it. This is what Zen practice trains us to do, is to change our experience of what we're going through, not this idea, that this egoistic idea that we have the power to change objective reality itself. Were the doctors telling you that? The doctors don't say much, but there are books they have written, or psychologists have, trying to get in on the breast cancer business. But to my chagrin, I was often encountering it from fellow sufferers. Individual women have written books, too, like my favorite, The Gift of Cancer, and it seems to be pretty ubiquitous. I wasn't finding any dissent, and when I tried to dissent on a message board, I was told to run, not walk, to therapy. Question. You write a lot about positive thinking, about how positive thinking is in all aspects of life. Do you think this is the most insidious about it, this idea of a disease being your fault? Ehrenreich, I look at it with a little bit of sociological detachment. It's a brilliant system of social control. When bad things happen to people, you say, well, it's really your attitude that has to change. So the danger, another way of articulating the danger in this balance is denial, as if denial of what is will cure you. Before we go into other forms of this positive thinking, I'm going to read from a... I'm just going to leave the Ehrenreich interview for a moment and read from a chapter of a book called The Human Side of Cancer, Living with Hope, Coping with Uncertainty. I was told about this book last week when I was visiting someone in our Sangha who is struggling with cancer, and I looked it up, and I'm going to read some segments of it. In the last couple of years, more of our members have been diagnosed with cancer, and you can be sure that there'll be many more to come. So perhaps focusing on this may help one or two people. The book, The Human Side of Cancer, is by Jimmy Holland, a physician at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And in this book, he explores the broad range of emotions people with cancer and their loved ones experience from the moment of diagnosis through the treatment and its aftermath. And then it begins with a couple of quotes. This is from John, a 52-year-old man with melanoma. I got really depressed when people said I should think positive. I thought, if that's what I have to do to survive, I'm never going to make it. And then this from Michael, a 45-year-old school teacher with recently diagnosed sarcoma. People keep telling me to be upbeat. I say, screw you. I'll be however I please in dealing with this cancer. I've never been upbeat in my life. I'm going to skip more than I plan to because there's a lot here. The author describes the case of a Jane whose signs were improving. The cancer was in remission, but she was still troubled when she came into his office, and it's because this idea that she hasn't been positive enough. When he couldn't, at first he was puzzled by her, her affect did not match the progress in the disease, so he asked her, "What makes you feel that way?" And she said, "Well, my sister gave me a book on how to survive cancer, and it says it's critical to keep a positive attitude. I've tried to stay upbeat through the treatments, but now that they're over, I'm more afraid and worried than ever. I'm sad and I can't feel positive about anything." And then he sympathizes with what she's been through and all, and she finally says, He acknowledges the stress, the everything that it takes out of you to go through cancer treatment. And she started to relax. You mean it's okay and I haven't kept my cancer from being killed off by chemotherapy because I couldn't do what the book said? No, you haven't, I said with a smile. You're not superwoman, you know. You're wonderfully human and normal. Most people experience the same reactions you've had at some time. Great, she said, because I was thinking that if any more people tell me to think positive, I'm going to slug them. Jane was echoing a refrain I often hear from people with cancer. The notion that feeling sad, scared, upset, or angry is unacceptable, and that emotions can somehow make your tumor grow. And the sense that if the person is not in control on the emotional plane all the time, the battle against the disease will be lost. I couldn't help but think, when I read this, of this cartoon I saw once where a visitor to a house is obviously quite frightened by this mean-looking dog, and the owner is saying to him, "Don't worry, he only bites if he senses fear." Of course, patients like Jane didn't come up with this notion on their own. It's everywhere in our culture, in popular books and tabloids, on every newsstand, on talk shows and TV, movies. For most patients, cancer is the most difficult and frightening experience they have ever encountered. All this hype claiming that if you don't have a positive attitude, if you get depressed, you are making your tumor grow faster, invalidates people's natural and understandable reactions to a threat to their lives. That's what I mean by the tyranny of positive thinking. This problem has been brought to me by well-meaning families who say, for example, "You have to help Dad. He's going to die because he isn't positive and he's not trying." On meeting Dad, I see that he clearly is a stoic, a man who copes well in his own quiet way. Maintaining a positive attitude just isn't his style. Insisting that he put on a happy face and cope in a way that would be foreign to him would actually be an added burden. To rob him of a coping mechanism that has worked before seems unfair, even cruel. Another downside of this tyranny of positive thinking is that Dad may feel guilty for failing his family if his disease should advance and he had been unable to change to a more Pollyanna-like stance. The additional negative consequences of these particular beliefs and myths about cancer lead to another phenomenon, blaming the person for getting cancer. Accusing questions such as, "Why did you need to get cancer?" You don't know whether to laugh or cry at these things. "You must have wanted to have cancer," suggests that the patient must have willed it to happen. Helen, a young woman with cancer, said to me with great sadness, "I feel as if I've been victimized twice. Once because I have a brain tumor, for which there is no known cause, and a second time because I am blamed, that it's my fault. It just isn't fair." The late Barbara Boggs Sigmund, who was the mayor of Princeton, New Jersey, became furious at the suggestion that she was somehow to blame for her eye cancer and its spread. In a New York Times op-ed piece, she expressed her rage at self-help books that presumed that I had caused my own cancer out of a, quote, "lack of self-love, need to be ill, or the wish to die, and that consequently was up to me to cure it." Ms. Sigmund repudiated the theory that, quote, "cancer cells are internalized anger gone on a field trip all over our bodies," or that, "rah, rah, sis, boom, bah, I can beat the odds if I only learn to love myself enough." And then he poses the question, how did this phenomenon of blaming the patient for the disease come about? It's undoubtedly related to the fact that cancer has been a mystery for so long as to both cause and cure. When we know little about something, we become even more frightened by it and develop myths to try to explain it and put it in some tolerable perspective. And then he mentions this is how it used to be with tuberculosis. And this was an insight that helped me in the current issue of Zenbo that came out recently. I wrote an article on illness in which I was wondering aloud in the article about why there is so much shame in Japan about contracting these illnesses. For centuries, TB has been kind of a taboo. For example, Zen Master Dogen died of, the historians now are and scholars are convinced that he died of tuberculosis, but that hasn't been acknowledged for centuries in Japan. And this I think, is one explanation for that. It's so frightening when you don't know, at the time you didn't know what it was from. AIDS was the same way, being diagnosed HIV positive. It's so mysterious and frightening that one way of coping with it in oneself or in one, someone close to you is to blame the person. When misfortune strikes, he writes, it is a natural human tendency to search for a reason. The ready explanation is often, he must have brought it on himself. By blaming the victim, we get a false sense of security that we can prevent events that are beyond our control. We seek to make sense of something that surely makes no sense at all. This woman in the Sangha I was talking with last week in the hospital, who has this fighting cancer, when she mentioned this book to me about this, the tyranny of positive thinking, she said, I think it comes from a feeling of helplessness. And I think that's what the author here is saying, that when we feel helpless, then we grasp at reasons that make no sense. And then one last thing here, this article. It's dangerous to generalize about attitudes and their impact on cancer without more information. The present-day tyranny of positive thinking sometimes victimizes people. If thinking positively works for you, well and good. He says earlier that if a positive attitude comes naturally to you, fine. Some people are optimistic, confident, and outgoing in virtually every situation. Your attitude toward illness reflects your attitude toward life in general and your handling of day-to-day stresses and hassles. There is no way you will see that the glass is half empty if you are certain that it is half full, and the converse is true. If you see the glass as half empty, I can't convince you that it's half full. It is not easy to change people's ingrained attitudes and patterns of coping. And then he ends the chapter by saying, it is ironic that many negative, this is important, please listen, that many negative, pessimistic people survive cancer, while others who believe positive attitudes will cure it do not. And now I'm going back to the Barbara Ehrenreich interview. The second big place where I encountered all this was in the kind of motivational services that are offered to laid-off white-collar workers, where every networking event or seminar, you get the same message about how it's really your attitude that is going to determine if you're going to get a job, and probably has something to do with why you lost that last one. You take people who have been really victimized, and I use that word advisedly, with cancer and with layoffs from unaccountable corporations, and then you tell them, well, you just have to change the way you think, and that's very clever. then she talks about how she feels that the positive thinking movement contributed to the subprime mortgage meltdown. We often blame the victim, the rather low-paid person who wound up with a subprime mortgage, but they were even hearing it from their preachers if they went to one of those mega-church positive-thinking preachers who said God wants you to have a larger house. Maybe you were never able to get any credit because of your race or your income, but you could be blessed suddenly. If someone offers you a mortgage that has no down payment and no proof of income, that's God coming down and saying, go get that house I wanted you to have. Far worse, and on a far larger scale, was the role of this ideology in the corporations and in the finance industry. You had companies who would literally fire people for being negative. Negative in the sense of maybe raising too many questions, maybe expressing a doubt. One example is the man who was the head of the real estate division of Lehman Brothers in 2006, and told his CEO that he thought the whole housing thing was a bubble and they should start getting out, and he was fired for that. So it's a culture of denial. The interviewer says, you write that the alternative to positive thinking isn't despair. What do you see as the alternative? And then she says what we all would know. How about a little realism? How about not seeing the world so totally colored by our own wishes and emotions? For the positive thinker, that means everything looks rosy and everything is going to be all right no matter what, so you have to block out the little warning signs. For the very depressed person, you're just convinced that everything is going to be miserable, that you're not going to enjoy anything you undertake, that you're going to fail at everything. There too, you're just projecting things. It's extremely hard to see things as they are. That is one of the ultimate Zen sayings. That's what Kensho means, seeing things as they are, not through our the projections of our own ideas. I would go one step further. In Zen would say, how about not even realism? Not pessimism, not optimism, even realism. Is if we hold to that as an attitude, then it still takes us away from just this, just what is. It's another ism. It's another notion. True realism is a no realism. No such concept. All of this applies, of course, to attitudes that may creep into the mind about coming to awakening. If you're thinking, I can do it, I can do it, I can do it, this isn't going to help you. Of course, just as bad, if not worse, is I can't do it. So how do you avoid the both positive and negative? Well, by absorbing yourself in your practice, just the breathing, just the koan. I just want to end by mentioning that as Americans, we're conditioned to think positively. I mean, this is one of the American traits that we're known for, is our optimism. I found myself going back to one of my all-time favorite books called Understanding Europeans. This is just such a fascinating book to me. It's by Stuart Miller, who's American, but he's married to a Belgian woman, and he wrote this book to help Americans understand Europeans, and it's about basic shared traits of Western Europeans. He mentions France, Belgium, Netherlands, Germany, Spain, Italy. In order to talk about these Western European traits, he compares them to American traits, the American character. And this is the segment I found here that relates to all this. Oh, he's talking in the larger chapter is about the American sort of denial of the material. He makes a very strong point throughout the book that we are very much geared toward the immaterial, which includes money. And that we're very much, compared to Europeans, Western Europeans, we have a kind of an avoidance or a mistrust of the physical, the sensual, and the body itself. So he's going on about this, and he says, from an American point of view, perhaps the most essential aspect of European materialism, even more important than land and food and underlying love for sensation, is their implicit belief that the body truly exists. We Americans, always mobile and upward bound, whether through class barriers or levels of spirituality or both, have little patience with the human body. We would, if we could, utterly deny its existence and importance. Since that, of course, is impossible, we attempt to dominate and shape it. We even work the most subtle attempts at mastery. Having learned from many European teachers, Freud, Reich, Selver, Rolf, and Feldenkrais, among others, some ways the body influences our whole lives, we have turned their findings upside down in order to put the body back in a subordinated place. Thus, we have elaborated an entire subculture of body-based therapies that attempt to use will skillfully to reshape the body and bend it to our immaterial notions. We make the body into a tool. We take their means and put them into an American agenda in which the fact of the body disappears beneath the discipline of the mind. This tendency is so great that much illness is increasingly seen as our fault, our mind over our body matter. A few years ago, one of America's most Europeanized intellectuals, Susan Sontag, afflicted with cancer, had to write an entire book to prove, one, that the illness was not her creation, and two, that in the face of exploding cells, there was little she could do about it with will and mind alone. The massive growth of interest in psychology in our country is in its deepest motives yet another attempt of Puritan will to win out over material resistance. Increasingly, American doctors will attribute physical diseases about which they can do little to hypothetical psychosomatic origins, thereby encouraging the American patient to feel he is, in some arcane and fuzzy way, responsible for them. Most American patients shoulder the burden. It is in our tradition. Our view of will is such that we feel we should be able to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. If so, we should be able to do anything, even make our bodies well. And then one last sentence. He says, as a general rule, Europeans have no such heroic views of human psychological capacities. For one thing, they are much more conscious, in a casual and popular fashion, of genetics. They do not see the individual as completely free as we tend to, and therefore responsible. They see him shaped and partly determined, even largely determined, by what has gone into his germ plasm. Well, then they can carry it too far, too. Always in Zen, we're faced with this balancing act, neither being too positive nor too negative, neither seeing ourselves as utterly free and undetermined by genetic and other factors, And the other extreme is feeling too determined by genetic and other factors that condition us. So we have this perfect practice, this wonderful practice to shake off all these notions and just be authentic, be with what is. And then we may recover or we may not, but at least we are in step with the way, the Tao. Stop now and recite the four vows.